Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about the Republican Party in the late 1940s and the development of the anti-communist climate of fear in America in the late 40s and early 50s. Today I'm looking at The Great Fear by David Coates. I've worked with quite a few of David Coates' books in the past, particularly his works on the fellow traveller movement. The European and American intellectuals who went to the Soviet Union during the 1930s. And he's a great observer of these kind of ideological high points of the 20th century, or some might argue low points, in the Western world. These interactions that the West had with communism, both favourable and negative. So here we look at the second chapter of the book, The Republican Catharsis. And David Coates starts by discussing the development of isolationism after the Second World War, which was just as pronounced, really, as the supposed isolationist shift in American popular thought after the First World War. So David Coates writes, "When we come to consider the isolationist sentiment that fueled the fires of domestic anti-communism in the late 40s and the 50s, we must distinguish between two types of isolationism. The first, Fortress America, turned its back on Europe, on the old corrupt world, out of disgust or disinterest, spurned involvement. The second was the product of an ultra-sensitivity about European politics among those sections of the American population, most notably the German Americans, who recognised in 1940 that the United States must either go to war with Germany or stay neutral." The First World War that ended in the Russian Revolution sent throughout Europe the immediate fear of revolution spreading, and in parts of Germany and in Hungary this indeed happens. There winds up in Hungary for a brief period of time Hungarian Soviet Republic, and in Bavaria, and across Europe from Ireland to Great Britain to France and Italy, there were either uprisings or indeed the fear and the anxiety of them. In Glasgow in Great Britain in 1919, the red flag is raised above the central square of the city, George Square in Glasgow, And Winston Churchill's Home Secretary even considers deploying tanks to George Square, which subsequently happens. And there is, in most industrial cities, a heightened fear of sedition and of the possibility of an uprising. In America, in 1919, 1920, 1921, the fear of the Russian Revolution somehow transmitting itself became concentrated with a spate of anarchist bombings, particularly a huge terrorist bombing on Wall Street, which became the sort of the focal point of, for example, the arrest of Sacco and Vanzetti. That was really why you wind up with that particular miscarriage of justice. The same thing, I guess, happens, the same kind of sensitivity to the transmission of revolutionary politics happens after World War II, once again, when the Soviet Union has made significant advances into Eastern Europe, when parts of the Third World appear to be moving ever closer towards some version of socialism, be it a kind of a more national liberation sort of movement that you would see emerging in Indochina, or what would then become Maoism. So there's this huge sense of concern about what is happening beyond America's borders, and the idea that dangerous ideas can be somehow magically transmitted across borders. And so this kind of isolationism, that by going to war in Europe you somehow bring back the worst and most frightening radical aspects of Europe, is something that really kind of animates popular fears. And the relationship that the Roosevelt administration had with the Soviet Union, that somehow Roosevelt had taken America into the wrong war, this sort of misguided, high-minded Democrat whose kind of notionally honourable but ultimately naive principles saw him cozying up to Stalin, this again gave the Republicans immense amounts of ammunition to suggest, you know, what had been shared, what kind of diplomatic relations had there been, what kind of transfer of information had there been. By 1949, when the Soviet Union developed the atomic bomb, and it turns out there are Soviet spies, atom spies, in America, the finger is quickly pointed at the Democrats and Roosevelt's legacy, saying, you know, if you hadn't been so weak and naive, none of this would have happened. So David Cope writes, it was this breed of isolationism that became a vengeful force in post-war America. The isolationism of regret, bitterness, betrayal, revenge. Many Americans felt that the outcome of the war, which had been demonstrably in the favour of the Soviet Union, had seen the United States and its principles played for fools, that men had fought and died for a notion of liberty, which was in at least half of Europe snuffed out once the war ended. In 1940, there were 23 counties in which Roosevelt lost over 35% of the vote, and that he had achieved in 1936. 19 of these were predominantly German-speaking in background. Samuel Lubon, the researcher, had concluded that attitudes towards American involvement in the Second World War largely governed attitudes towards McCarthy. And the reason for this is telling. A study, for example, of Pierce County in Wisconsin showed that McCarthy received a disproportionate support of people from German descent. Lubel wrote, in not one of the German-American counties I visited did I find a single person who believed a settlement with Russia was possible. So there were a significant number of German, American, and other European American communities, Georgians, Armenians, Hungarians, Czechs, in America's cities, in America's countryside, who had long and bitter memories of the, not just of the Soviet Union, but of the Russian Empire prior to that. And they believed emphatically, many of them, that any attempt to find peaceful coexistence and peaceful collaboration with the USSR after 1945 was at best naive, at worst treacherous. In the Midwest, Republicans recorded 76% opposition to foreign aid bills, for example, in 1952, and 65% in 1955. However, along the East Coast and the Pacific Coast, Republicans recorded only 19% opposition to the foreign aid bill of 1955. And this indicates more of the kind of the first type of isolationism, simply that insularity that you can often find in the centre of large countries where the question of sending money overseas or having engagements with countries overseas seems kind of meaningless or absurd or downright counterproductive or harmful. And so it was the senators from the Midwest solidly opposed the criticism and the censure of McCarthy in 1954. Why? Because they understood their electorates. They understood that McCarthy was speaking for the Midwest, the heartlands of America. The message of Joseph McCarthy did not resonate quite as well in California or New York State. And there is something in that truth that has kind of echoed through every extreme iteration of Republican politics that's happened since. Nixon, Reagan, Bush the Second, and currently Donald Trump are all well aware that they are able to present themselves not as the kind of rapacious mouthpieces of a kind of extreme iteration of free market capitalism that they clearly are, but as tribunes of the people, as people who understand the common touch, the folksy, familiar guy you can have a beer with of George W. Bush, or the kind of the down-home cowpoke that he presented himself as opposed to kind of a failed Ivy League playboy with a drink problem. Anti-communism and isolationism aren't always exactly the same thing. It's important not to simply reduce anti-communism and red baiting down to the desire to be kind of in isolation. The many Slavic Americans, for example, who'd supported Roosevelt and the war against Germany were outraged against the Soviet takeover of Eastern Europe. The indignation of Catholics of Irish descent when blended and mixed in with the resentments of German Americans matured into a kind of a new and often kind of plebeian working class patriotism. The Catholic Church, of course, being one of the long-standing opponents of Soviet communism and of kind of democratic socialism in general. So in 1945, isolationism was perhaps emerging as a force, but it would take a year or two really for it to kind of appear in earnest on the kind of political agenda. The development of things like the United Nations, which had bipartisan support during the 1944 presidential campaign meant that it wasn't politically expedient to talk of putting up the drawbridge. During 1944, a number of isolationist congressmen and senators actually lost their seats. The Senate consented to the UN Charter by 89-2. Eisenhower, who returned in late 1945 from a trip to Moscow, announced that both the US and the Soviet Union were anti-colonialist, each wanted friendship with one another, and were committed to the development of the United Nations.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Gradually, bit by bit, the fear that the direction of US foreign policy, which could roughly be described as kind of liberal internationalism, that this would involve higher taxation and government control of the economy, the aid would go straight into the pockets of socialists and ungrateful foreigners to create a global welfare state for the indigent and the envious. Now, this is kind of the stuff of conspiracy theorists, but that's not to say that at certain points in American history or the history of any other country that conspiracy theorists don't actually have the kind of the controlling factor in public discourse. Conspiracy theories, whilst, you know, very often nonsense, still can have an immense amount of power. And it's important to kind of pick apart the anxieties about America's internationalism, the idea that America would potentially intervene in other countries for other reasons in order to extend the values of liberal democracy and free market capitalism. The world that Americans looked at in 1945 was certainly one that would merit those kinds of interventions, and there was a question at the end of the Second World War whether America was willing to intervene in countries like Poland, for example. The answer, of course, was there was no question of that happening. But for many Americans whose taxes had dramatically increased during the Second World War and who had seen a dramatic increase in the government management of the economy, as has to happen during wars of that magnitude, there was a desire among many to return to peacetime conditions and a belief, which is normally never possible after major wars, that the conditions that had existed in before 1941 could be rapidly reapplied, and that the status quo could be kind of restored. There was also this fear that the United States would be offering handouts to the rest of the world, and these handouts were going to the pockets of the most undeserving, that the Soviet Union might hoover up American cash and have its oppressive regime supported by American handouts. One of the fears was that in Congress was that as Great Britain embraced a more democratic socialist future following the victory of the Labour Party in the summer of 1945 and the building of a welfare state, that the desire of Great Britain for a grant of aid, which was approached in August 1945 and eventually whittled down to a loan under some fairly unfavourable circumstances, that this would wind up subsidising not just the British Empire but socialism at home in Great Britain. David Coate writes, Colonel Robert R. McCormick, proprietor of the Chicago Tribune, backed American Action Incorporated, heir to America First, sympathetic to fascism organisation during the 1930s and early 1940s, featuring Charles Lindbergh, that tried to steer America away from war with Germany. Supported by Lamont DuPont, Upton Close and others, these great sort of capitalist kind of oligarch types, this organisation acted as a lightning rod for anti-British, anti-democratic and sometimes anti-Semitic sentiment. The British Labour government's introduction of nationalisation measures and a welfare state exacerbated fears of socialism as a halfway house to communism. Coate continues to say, resentments about the style, the privilege, about the aloofness of East Coast Ivy League intellectuals whose allegiances resided in mid-Atlantic or further east, and who aped the manners of British aristocrats while pouring American taxes into the pockets of British socialists. These passions also fueled the new domestic anti-communism. McCormick's Chicago Tribune described Dean Acheson in 1949 as a striped pants snob who ignores the people of Asia, betrays true Americanism to serve as a lackey of Wall Street bankers, British lords, and communistic radicals from New York. Senator Hugh Butler of Nebraska said of Acheson, I watch his smart aleck manner and his British clothes and that New Dealism, I want to shout, get out, get out. You stand for everything that has been wrong with the United States for years. And there, the kind of support of the new British welfare state, which I think is exaggerated, and it's an exaggeration to suggest that the Truman administration supported anything of the sort. But that was tied in with the loathing by the Republican Party of the New Deal and the belief that this was a terrible thing that happened to America. And the combination of the two fueled this new kind of anti-communism. Now, to take us on a slight diversion, I have recently been reading David Edgerton's book, The Rise and Fall of the British Nation. And in it, he says that the Britain as a country is still here, but there have been a series of British nations. One particularly, he says, a new kind of nation began in 1945. And when he talks about nations, he talks about how the people within a polity popularly imagine that nation, how they popularly imagine together what society is about. And he refers to it as a specific historical formulation. And in 1945, Great Britain becomes this new historical formulation, according to David Edgerton, one with a new welfare state, a national health service, a commitment to full employment, and a new national sentiment, a sentiment that roughly of a greater collectivism. I believe that McCarthyism is in part the development of a new sense of nationhood, that people who supported McCarthy, who lived amongst the kind of the swirling post-war resentments and fears, who looked at what America was and what America should stand for, who drew from the past traditions of kind of limited government, notions of liberty, and the more recent past, America's wartime experience, and America's good fortune to be a economic superpower at the end of the war. And there is a way of seeing not only America as being historically distinct or exceptional, and as something like socialism as being a fundamentally un-American idea, something that is kind of does not compute with the national psyche, even though there had been socialists in America long as there had been socialist ideas, that this new sense of national identity emerges particularly within certain parts of America. Certain nations seem to exist, certain parts of, you know, the Midwest, the kind of notion of the heartlands. And in the development of that idea of nation emerging there, a schism that had perhaps always existed between the centre and the coasts becomes more pronounced. It is interesting that the critique of Acheson as the sort of the sneering liberal intellectual whose manners are more foreign and his loyalties appear to be more cosmopolitan than that of the traditional heartlands of America, that's a kind of a prevalent theme. And I think one of the important parts of looking at McCarthyism is one of the ways in which we kind of make sense of much of the post-war era, these huge lurches towards kind of more reactionary thinking, particularly under Nixon, that we have to remember were significantly popular at the time. Both Joseph McCarthy and Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and a host of other figures on the populist right have been able to have success because what they've been saying has resonated with the fears and the ambitions and the hopes and the dreams and the sense of self that significant numbers of people in America have had. This is the thing about populism, is it is ultimately speaks to the popular. Seems obvious to say, but it's where bears repeating nonetheless. So we're going to continue this week with a couple of other podcasts on America in the 40s and 50s. And we'll get a little bit deeper into looking at McCarthyism and the anti-communist period from 1947 and to the mid-50s in general. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. I hope you found this useful. And if you can swing by our Patreon page and support us, that would be great. Thanks very much, everybody, and I'll catch you soon. All the best. Bye-bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.